From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The latest book from Gore Vidal, the celebrated novelist, historian, essayist, political commentator, screenwriter, and playwright, is Point to Point Navigation, the sequel to his best-selling memoir, Palimpsest. This one chronicles the second half of Mr. Gore's extraordinary life from 1964 to this year. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gore Vidal back to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
So why have you called it Point to Point Navigation?
Well, had to call it something.
So
no, it was, you know, in the war, I was a first mate of an army ship up in the Aleutian Islands. And you couldn't chart a course because the weather was so bad. You couldn't use the compass, really, because there was no sun, there was no moon, there were no stars. So we did what was called point-to-point navigation, which seemed a nice metaphor for my life. Which is you had to sort of memorize the terrain, what's happening on.
It's okay. It sounds fine.
It sounds fine.
Now, so you have to memorize the terrain, because this book sounds at times like these memories come out of diaries or journals, but I suspect that that's not what happened.
They come out of an ancient and failing memory, and I am just recalling things, and I've always said that what I do when I very rarely write about myself, it's always memory, as I remember things. So it's not autobiography, which has to be really pretty strict. It has to be as strict as biography. You have to double-check and so forth and so on. And it's as you remember things. It's memory's a very strange thing, as all of us know from experience. Have you ever been in a situation in the past in which you've run into somebody who was also in the same situation? Does he remember anything about it the way you did? Everybody always has a different version. And you eventually get different versions from your own memories. Why is that? Physiologically, what happens if you break your leg when you're, 10 years old? Then you try and remember it when you're 40 years old, and you think you've remember everything about it, but you don't remember anything. What you do, in other words, the mind is not full of tapes that all you have to do is press a button and you get to see it again. The mind records things in a very, very funny way. In other words, what you remember is the last time that you remembered it, by which time it could be 20 times away from the actual breaking of the leg. This makes memory so fascinating. I mean, why have I lost these details? And if you record what you're doing, or what you have done, or what you have remembered, you're going to get first palimpsest, as I define the word in the first volume, which is just one memory on top of another, all leaking into each other.
But in that book, you surmise that location or objects in a room can influence memory.
Well, yes.
So was that a factor here as well?
No, because I did not go back to the Aleutian Islands, having served my time for my country up there. So I've never been back to the Aleutians. But I can, try and remember. But
I thought
actually,
you'd lost all of your
Aleutians. What I'm remembering is the last 40 years of my life since I finished Palimpsest and what had gone on and so forth. And recording it as best I could.
You observed in Palimpsest that writers often forget what they've forgotten, since the act of writing is simply a letting go of a piece of one's mind.
Yes, I did write that, and I do believe that. I think one of the reasons we do write is sometimes to get rid of things that we don't want to think about, or we have nothing more to say on the subject. And by writing, you exercise it. It's over with. You hope.
You refer quite a bit to Mantegna and his essays in this book. He was a master of the personal essay. Is that one of your favorite forms?
Oh, the personal essay I've always loved, and that's why I've always steered clear of memoirs, except for rare occasions like the current book and palimpsest before it. I think American writers spend far too much time writing about themselves, and since most of them are very, very boring, I hope I tread on no toes here, but most writers have rather dull lives. And particularly American writers, and most of whom are school teachers. And school teachers do not live the most vivid lives. So they write about themselves and, you know, how they didn't get tenure at Ann Arbor that year because of the au pair girl, and the child was born autistic, and that, you know, it's just heartbreaking, heartbreaking. And I stay miles away from that kind of a book.
Yeah, but you have not lived a boring life, and you reveal contact with quite a few people, interesting people. Your own experiences, which we will get into, are often quite interesting. So yours is not the typical writer's life. Hello, is he still there? I think we may have lost Gore Vidal. I think we're going to take a little break here and try to reestablish contact with Gore Vidal. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast. We're back with Gore Vidal, whose new memoir, Point to Point Navigation, has just been published by Doubleday. And when we were so rudely interrupted, we were talking about Mantegna, whose essays often followed wherever his thought processes took him. And that's something you also do in this book.
Well, I'm a student of Montaigne. And after all, he was the first essayist in practically any language. Greeks, Romans like Cicero, basically wrote essays, what they call them, letters to friends. And in a sense, an essay is a letter to your friend, the world. So I was much influenced by him, and the book is full of hints from him on how to remember stuff. Happy to say that Montaigne's memory was just as bad as mine. I mean, he said, you know, people quote me to me, and I don't even remember me. So I think that happens with age. Anyway, no, Montaigne I love for many reasons, and I include a wonderful passage by him in the book on how he says of all vices, telling lies should be rewarded with a capital offense, in other words, with execution. And I've always believed that. And now that we live in a nation of liars, particularly at the top of the country, but it leaks through to everything, to the used car man, to your nearby senator. And it's pretty grim, because Montaigne says very clearly, and I quote him at considerable length, which I shall not do now, but he said, you know, our words are the only thing that makes us human. And it is our words to each other that if they are not true and in good faith, we have no civilization. We have nothing. And I thought that enormously profound, and I think about it every day of my life, particularly when I'm following an election, as we were doing a couple of days ago, one with a joyous conclusion, which we don't usually get.
You wrote that C-SPAN is the only exciting and useful American television on offer.
Yes, because it is true reality, at least at its most boring, which is often. It's very great. because it's all those Senate hearings that you get out of the House of Representatives, in which real people who are real representatives or alleged to be of the people get together and argue about money, which, after all, is the one thing America cares about. And it's there, watching C-SPAN, that you get into the boiler room of the Republic. So there is no committee hearing too tedious for me not to be overexcited by it.
Even though you grew up with it, because your grandfather was in the Senate for quite a while.
He was in the Senate for many, many years, and he served on the Finance Committee. And then, unfortunately for me, he was chairman for years. He was a very great chairman of agriculture, which is about as interesting to me as molecular dust from which the stars come. So our minds did not meet on... He always remembered the head of the Grange, which is a great sort of organization for America's farmers. This is when farming was the number one thing in the country. And the guy would always come before Senator Gore's committee, and he would say, Senator Gore would say, "Well, tell me, John, how are things in agriculture?" John would shake his head and say, "Senator, for the 20th year, they have been below average, the yields." My grandfather would roar with laughter over that one.
Well, you ran for Congress, and then you ran for Senate.
Yes.
And I guess you,
I was
many of us,
myself.
Well, many of us would have considered spending a lot of time in Washington a tedious experience, but obviously it was something that you would have liked to have done.
Oh, I was designed to do it. Yes, I can put up with any amount of tedium, which has behind it a real subject, which is whether it's agriculture or the finances of the country.
Well, considering the way fiction has been used against some people during the current election,
Did you watch Lynn Cheney lying about her book?
I watched her on television, yes.
Fascinating, because you don't get to see a really major liar up close. And suddenly, there she was. She was trapped. Instead of telling part of the truth and getting out of it, she had to tell a big lie. Were the two women described in your novel lesbians? Possibly they could have been. I don't know.
Except that they engaged in sexual activity.
Yeah. And to watch her lie, I must say I did not feel sorry for her. She was as hostile a presence as I've ever seen on television. And she is full of herself. I mean, she likes to lecture the nation on our history. You know, she doesn't know anything about it. And she's very, very partisan.
But what about Wolf Blitzer, who did not really follow up on that? Did that disappoint you at all?
Oh, Wolf is there to disappoint. He always has been, you know. He has that awfully, you know, really annoying voice. And he sounds so weary when he gets on. Well, after you murdered the vice president, what did you feel? You know, he starts in like that. He makes noises.
Let's talk about something else. You lost your lifetime partner, Howard Austin, in 2003. Did writing down memories help to deal with his death?
No. Nothing helps.
Well, you've written about your last moments together. That must have been very difficult.
Well, it was not easy to write, no. But then, by and large, writing, if you're trying to write well, is never very easy. And certainly it was bringing back sad memories, tragic memories.
And since you point out that it's about writing well, and you are somebody whose style has often wowed your readers, how does that work? If you're working on something, writing something very personal, do you think about style?
Well, you know, I don't write about me very often. That's why I call these memories and memoirs, which are just memories of things, and it isn't properly speaking me sitting down and analyzing anything that of a personal nature. It's just not my way. But writing about the death of somebody you cared about is not easy, as I believe anyone who's ever had to write a condolence letter about somebody they cared about, or in response to a condolence letter. I mean, we all have to do these things. After a certain age, we do them more and more often, so we get a bit more skilled at it, but it's painful.
You describe a conversation you had with Joan Didion about her book, The Year of Magical Thinking, which was about the death of her husband.
Yeah.
Comparing notes on the problems of writing this kind of book?
No, we were comparing notes on what it was like after a lifetime with somebody, mm-hmm. that they were gone.
And then you write about recent deaths of other people you've known, Johnny Carson, Saul Bellow, Arthur Miller. I assume that you're finding yourself more and more preoccupied with thoughts about death these days.
Well, I am 81, you know. I'm in training for the end.
You're in training.
For the end, yes.
You open the book with the observation that the only thing you ever liked to do was to go to the movies, and you got involved with the movies. You were the last contract writer hired by MGM.
Yes, I was.
And the
only reason I was the last, why I took the job, I knew that MGM was going to fold fairly soon, and I also wanted to know how the engine that had produced so many movies that I had loved growing up, I wanted to see how it worked, and so I became part of it practically to the end itself.
Were you satisfied with the end results of your work in Hollywood? Is there a film you're particularly proud of?
No, I'm working for the movies is, always disappointing and disagreeable. Nothing ever turns out the way you want it, because even then, this is 30, 40 years ago, even then there were too many people around who had too much power over the final product. Just the very word product gives away the game. They would have been happier, doing shredded wheat biscuits. They didn't care what they were doing. They were just trying to sell stuff. So most of them, these are the people who are in charge of marketing, in charge of the executives in charge of the studio. They were not of much use to anybody on earth, and you had to find ingenious ways of getting around them. Some writer directors were very good at it, and some were not. I was not.
Well, you also had written novels before, and you don't have to worry about other people when you write novels. Maybe you get into a little dispute with your editor once in a while. You went from the movies to writing plays. Were plays more satisfying? Was it a more interesting process?
Well, yes, it's more immediate. Those are your words in the mouths of good actors being projected to living people. So you have joined a kind of circle of, instruction, information, whatever word you want to use, reality. I always thought of Tennessee, who was a great short story writer. And he wrote these magnificent short stories over a 40-year period. Then one by one, he turned them into Streetcar Named Desire, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. These all began as short stories. Why? Because the only way that Tennessee could ever come alive was through a production. And that meant what he had, in a lonely way, had written as a short story. He then looked at it and thought, I can make a play out of this. He makes the play out of it, but the play doesn't exist until it's acted. So he is moving out of something that comes from the recesses of his mind to something that could be living and vital and that he could watch take shape along with an audience, along with the rest of the world, as he was a great world playwright. So the whole world saw his inner stories dramatized and revealed. So he was hungry for productions. Everybody thought, oh, how vain he is, and he just always wants to be the center of attention in a rehearsal hall and so on. No way. What he had imagined, the characters that he had imagined, he once said to me, he said, I cannot identify with anyone for whom I do not have sexual desire. And that was always the case in the plays. There was always somebody there that he was erotically moved by.
You refer to him as the glorious bird.
The glorious bird, well, the image of a glorious bird keeps cropping up in his work all the time. And finally, I just nicknamed him that, and then suddenly everybody else did too. And at the end, he would sign his letters to me, the glorious bird. He was indeed. He was forever in flight. But it was only in the act of rehearsal and then of the production itself that Tennessee came alive. And then he had a whole new life. There he was with his alternative world, which was fiction. And he had made it come to life with real people acting it out. And to watch him as the play took shape, even if it was a bad play or one that was not working very well, he was another person during the production itself.
Now, he didn't write plays that had political sides to them. You have. Do you wish there were more politics in our literature and our popular culture?
Of course I do. I wish there was more politics in our politics. However, I do my best out here on the margins.
Well, you've been an outspoken critic of the Bush administration and just told us that you are quite thrilled with the election results. What do you think the Democrats should do first? Or, first of all, you're going to have to wait until January. So what do you think is going to happen until the Democrats assume control of Congress?
Well, there's going to be a lot of many, many hearings. We have to find out all the crimes that have been committed, you know, the name of the people of the United States.
Well, you know, Gore, all of the editorial writers are saying the Democrats should not do that sort of thing. They should.
I mean, who has ever taken seriously an American newspaper, for God's sake? They're the most corrupt things in the country from 1787 on. I don't take anything they write. They are paid for hacks, generally by the same people who pay for the politicians. So I don't think we have anything to look forward to the New York Times' opinion of anything. Use it to light your fire with.
And you think the Democrats should really go after the Republicans and find
out? Well, if they want to get the Republic back. Now, maybe they don't want it. I came to the conclusion over the last few years, as one by one the Bill of Rights were being erased, the day that we got rid of habeas corpus, which we've had for 900 years, since Magna Carta was signed at Runnymede in England, that is the basis of our liberties. Well, we got rid of that. Then we got rid of due process of law, which is twinned with it. Was there any protest? No, because I don't think anybody at the New York Times knows what the Magna Carta is. It doesn't seem like an invitation anywhere on the west side or east side. I come off it. Our media is hopeless. It is totally corrupt. It is owned by the same people who gave us the Bush administration, who also give us the Democratic Party, which I hope will be somewhat better due to its time of penance, out of office or out of control of things. They've got to begin investigating what has happened to us, because it's going to take two generations to get the Constitution back, to restore what has been destroyed by this crazed administration, in tandem with the New York Times and the other newspapers and the media that goes along with it. This is a tough battle up ahead, and I hope they're ready for it. I'm happy that Judiciary will be in the charge of Leahy in the Senate and Conyers in the House of Representatives. These are two very good men, and I don't have much faith in anything, but I have some faith in them.
Gore Vidal is the author of 25 novels, 6 plays, many screenplays, more than 200 essays, and the critically acclaimed memoir Palimpsest. His United States Essays, 1952 to 1992, won the National Book Award in 1993. Now he has a second volume of memoirs called Point to Point Navigation. It's from Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.